Welcome to Law Talk, the Legal Scholarship Podcast. I'm your host, Nathan Oman, Assistant Professor at William & Mary Law School. You can find Law Talk online at www.concurringopinions.com. Just look on the left side of the page under the Categories heading and click on Law Talk. There you can find past episodes as well as information on how to subscribe. Over the weekend, I had the opportunity to attend the meetings of the American Society for Legal History, which were held this year in Tempe, Arizona, under the auspices of Arizona State University. It's a wonderful conference. I presented a paper on my research into the resolution of civil disputes in ecclesiastical courts, specifically Mormon church courts in the 19th century. I'd known for a long time that in the 19th century, Mormons had a rule that you weren't supposed to sue other Mormons, but all of those sorts of disputes were to be resolved in church courts. And I was curious as to how these courts dealt with contract cases, since that's one of my main areas of research. So at the beginning of this year, I began doing research on this subject, looking through the records of these courts to seeing how they dealt with contract cases. And I began writing my research up. Now, as often happens in these cases, I initially thought that the first part of my Mormon contract law paper would deal with the question of how these courts developed, why it was that Mormons decided they wanted to resolve all their civil disputes in church courts, and why it was that this was abandoned at the end of the 19th century. After I'd spent 2 or 3 months doing the research on this introductory section and my paper had grown to about 40 pages, I decided that this was an independent article. And this presentation at ASLH summarizes at least some of the findings that I've had. I'm hoping that ultimately I'll publish this research later this year. I have a extended manuscript which should be sent off to the law reviews this spring. So keep your eyes peeled for that. And without further ado, here is my presentation at the ASLH. On the evening of September 9, 1831, two men arrived in the small county seat of Jacksonville, Illinois. It was court day, and there were, according to a diarist, a great many country people in the village. Illinois law required that all members of the state Supreme Court hold circuit in each county seat at least twice a year. In their wake came the lawyers who rode circuit with the judges and others who came to watch the spectacle of the court. This September evening, however, afforded the citizens of Morgan County a different kind of performance. The first of the two men was a school teacher turned preacher named William McClellan, and his companion was Hiram Smith, brother of the Mormon prophet Joseph Smith, Jr. McClellan recorded in his journal, "As soon as they found out who we were, they gathered around us, and we separated and talked to them for 2 hours. I cut some so close with the truth that a ruffian fellow rolled up his sleeves and swore that he would give it to me, but a gentleman prevented him and took him away." The two Mormon elders made an appointment to preach next day in the courthouse. At the designated time, a numerous concourse of people gathered, and McClellan recorded his trepidation at having to ascend the judge's bench and face judges, lawyers, doctors, priests, and people. "But," he added, "I arose with confidence in Elijah's God and gave them a brief history of the Book of Mormon, etc." 5 years later, a larger group of Mormon elders gathered in Kirtland, Ohio, then headquarters of the Mormon Church. They made their way to the recently completed Kirtland Temple, which sat above the Chagrin River. Despite the geographic and symbolic distance between them and the judges, lawyers, and village rowdies of Morgan County, however, the Kirtland elders were also essentially a judicial gathering. After opening with prayer, they turned to the case of Cahoon v. Green. Elder Cahoon was charged Elder Green, quote, "first, for disturbing the singing school several times, second, for swearing and calling the complainant a liar." Green denied the charge of disturbing the peace, but admitted to the swearing and slander. After considering and rejecting Green's defense that Cahoon was in fact a liar, the assembled elders voted to withdraw their fellowship from him. The juxtaposition of Mormon elders preaching in the courthouse and adjudicating in the temple illustrates the tension between litigation and religion in early America. A number of religious denominations sought to opt out of secular legal systems, pushing all civil disputes between church members into church courts. This push broke down on essentially theological lines. Those movements coming out of the Radical Reformation, in particular the Anabaptists, and out of Calvinism, inherited a strong emphasis on church discipline, which meant that adjudication emerged as an important religious activity. Already equipped with the institutional machinery, It was a relatively simple matter for these groups to expand the jurisdiction of church courts to include civil disputes. What this meant in practice was that Quakers, Baptists, and to a lesser extent Presbyterians and Congregationalists tended to discipline and excommunicate their members and take their lawsuits to church courts. On the other hand, denominations with differing theological roots, for example Episcopalians and Lutherans, did not. Mormonism emerged from the radical edges of the Second Great Awakening, drawing converts mainly from Baptist, Quaker, and various post-Puritan religious traditions. In short, from among the discipline-oriented churches. Unlike the Protestant structures from which it emerged, however, the mature Mormon judiciary was more than simply a congregationally based method of policing church purity. It was a single, institutionally integrated system with a three-tiered appellate structure that was ideologically related to key aspects of Mormon theology. In September of 1834, the Kirtland High Council and early Mormon court met, and Joseph Smith, founder and prophet of the new church, according to the minutes, said that he would show the order of councils in ancient days, as shown him by vision, the law by which to govern the council of the Church of Christ. In reaching their decisions, the council was to speak precisely according to the evidence and according to the teachings of the Spirit of the Lord. Likewise, in cases of difficulty, the president may inquire and obtain the mind of the Lord by revelation. Church courts were thus embedded in theological narratives of pristine Christianity, authentic priestly authority, restored in the latter days. Likewise, the process of decision-making in Mormon courts explicitly rested on claims to continuing and immediate revelation from God. In short, Mormon courts became a key location in which Latter-day Saints experienced the divine and enacted the theological narratives that structured their beliefs. Church litigation began when a plaintiff filed a written complaint with the clerk of a local bishop's court or the larger regional court called a high council. The clerk issued a summons to the defendant. Defendants who refused to appear risked excommunication for contempt of the priesthood. The parties presented evidence and the council would issue a decision. Appeals could be taken from a bishop's court to the high council and from thence to the highest Mormon tribunal known as the First Presidency. A Mormon sued by another Mormon in secular court would file a counter-complaint before a church court alleging unchristian-like conduct in bringing suit. The church court would then take jurisdiction over the entire dispute and resolve the underlying lawsuit on the merits. Failure to carry the final decision into effect resulted in excommunication. As might be expected, losing parties were not always satisfied with the decisions of church courts. For example, in 1849, when one victorious plaintiff called at a defendant's house to claim property to which the high council had declared him entitled, the irate defendant responded, "The council might go to hell and be damned." In another case, a diarist recorded that a losing party in a high council case was dissatisfied with their judgment and told them that it was no better than robbery. However, one non-Mormon observer insisted that in 99 cases out of 100, the parties are satisfied. Indeed, occasionally Gentiles, as Mormons called non-Mormons, sued Mormons in church court rather than secular fora. For example, in one case, an influential bishop had run up several thousand dollars of debt to a Gentile merchant. The merchant brought suit against the bishop in a church court in preference to going to law. After a 90-minute trial, the church court ruled that the bishop should pay the full amount in 28 days or be suspended from his bishopric. The Mormon objection to suing before the ungodly was tied up with the spectacle of litigation. Court day was an important civic ritual in 19th century America. Few towns had permanent magistrates other than justices of the peace, and more complicated cases were handled by circuit courts that met usually twice a year at county seats. These gatherings were major social, economic, and political events. Court sessions were accompanied by peddlers on the courthouse square hawking their wares, which generally included generous amounts of alcohol. Drunken fights were common. Indeed, they were part of the appeal of court day, as one diarist complained in 1807, a very poor court, no fighting or gouging, very few drunken people. Indeed, there was a symbiotic relationship between courthouses and taverns. Many frontier courts sat in the public rooms of taverns in the absence of courthouses. And likewise, in some cases, taverns were purposefully located close to courthouses to service the people who gathered to watch the judges and lawyers. In short, according to one scholar, courtroom trials provided prime entertainment for the community. It was precisely this theatrical aspect of litigation, however, that concerned the Latter-day Saints. In February of 1856, Brigham Young delivered a blistering sermon against lawyers and law courts. He began his denunciation by describing the performance of a lawyer he had observed the day before. Quote, "He was so serious, so religious, so pious, and so honest, that he appealed to high heaven to witness his honesty before the jury. But when he had induced the jury to believe that he was honest, he stood there and misrepresented the merits of the case for half an hour at a stretch, in regular lawyer style." However, while Young's remarks were severe upon the lawyers and their clients, he spent most of his sermon castigating the spectators. Quote, "It is a shame for men to be found loafing about in such places where there is contention and quarreling and every stratagem that can be used to deceive juries and witnesses, and lying before them with all the grace and sanctity of a saint pretending to be one. Such a place is darker to me than midnight darkness." He went on to say, "Elders of Israel throng to such a place, and that too when no spirit reigns there but the devil's spirit. You can get nothing from that den but the principles of hell." More colorfully, he called litigation the fog, the froth, the spawn of hell that the spectators feast upon. It was not simply the contentiousness of litigation or the dishonesty of the lawyers themselves that was objectionable. It was the moral impact on the community of placing such a spectacle at the center of civic life. Seen in these terms, the move to bring litigation within the church was a move to transform its public meaning. Initially, the Mormons had their own muted version of court day. In 1852, shortly after the Territory of Utah was organized, Zerubbabel Snow, a Mormon attorney who had been appointed as Chief Justice of the new territorial Supreme Court, rode circuit through the settlements inaugurating the first district courts. However, he did not enter town at the head of a judicial entourage with lawyers in tow. Rather, he came as a small part of a much larger party led by Brigham Young, who spoke to the citizens as territorial governor and, far more important from their point of view, preached to them as living prophet and leader of their church. In this theopolitical pageant, Justice Snow was decidedly a bit player. In place of the secular ritual court day, the church courts offered their own set of public symbols. Adjudication was often held in public, and church trials were sometimes announced in local newspapers. During the 1850s, the Salt Lake High Council heard cases each Saturday morning in the Salt Lake Social Hall before large groups of spectators who were occasionally called upon to participate in the proceedings. Men in the audience might be asked to replace a high counselor who was absent or recused himself. Likewise, in one 1859 case, the persons present in the room, according to the minutes, were called upon and also unanimously sustained the decision, about 50 persons present besides the authorities and councils. Perhaps most dramatically, decisions by church courts frequently required erring parties to publicly confess their sins before their congregations or to engage in acts of public reconciliation. In short, ecclesiastical courts transformed adjudication from a spectacle of amoral attorneys engaged in a battle of wits into an essentially Christian drama of sin, confession, reconciliation, and public redemption, a fact not lost on contemporary observers. For example, one diarist recorded the deliberations in an 1843 case using the language of Christian atonement, noting Hiram pled for mercy, Joseph for justice, and the 12 decided according to testimony. The goal, as the minutes of the meeting put it, was for all differences settled and hearts of all run together in love. After 70 years or more of practice, the Mormons ultimately abandoned the resolution of civil disputes in church courts, reserving them for more traditional questions of church discipline. The end of their expansive jurisdiction was a ragged affair that involved both an official retreat from certain kinds of cases and a gradual abandonment of the church courts by rank-and-file Mormons. Ultimately, the shift had two causes. First, new religious narratives for the work of Mormon lawyers changed Mormon attitudes towards the law. Second, as Mormon country became integrated into the national economy, ecclesiastical courts increasingly faced disputes that they had neither the technical expertise nor the remedial machinery to effectively handle. As the 19th century progressed, Mormons continued to treat the legal profession with suspicion, but they simultaneously sought to sanctify it by embedding Mormon lawyers in the narratives of priesthood authority and revelation that stood at the core of the church judiciary. For example, in the early 1880s, the ecclesiastical superior of a young man considering law school told him, "You will go to hell," and urged him to consult with then-president of the church, John Taylor. The young man met with Taylor, who attempted to dissuade him from law school. When he was unconvinced, Taylor laid hands on his head and gave him a blessing that cautiously sanctified his legal education. quote, "Brother Moyle, in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, and by virtue of the holy priesthood, we lay our hands on thy head to seal upon thee a blessing. We say unto thee that law is a dangerous profession, one that leads many people down to destruction. However, if thou wilt abstain from arguing falsely and on false principles, maintaining only the things which can be honorably sustained by honorable men, the Lord God will bless thee in this calling with wisdom and intelligence and with the light of revelation." Using language normally reserved for men chosen as missionaries or for other church positions, the blessing concluded, "We set thee apart to go forth as thou hast desired, to study and become acquainted with the principles of law and equity." The coming of the Transcontinental Railroad in 1869 marked the beginning of the integration of Mormon country into the national economy. Unsurprisingly, these forces changed the nature of litigation, presenting problems that the church courts were ultimately ill-equipped to deal with. The economic depression of 1893 provides an illustration. Beginning with panics in London and New York, the depression swept through the nation's economy, throwing thousands out of work and drying up credit for troubled enterprises. Mormon businessmen in Utah found themselves scrambling to secure repayment of debts in a falling market that was pushing many into bankruptcy. The natural move in this situation would be for the creditor to obtain a lien on the debtor's property as rapidly as possible to secure repayment regardless of how the debtor's assets were distributed. The church courts, however, could only apply personal pressure to the litigants before them. They lacked the ability to provide the kind of in rem remedies needed in the context of a race for the courthouse. The result was a Hobson's choice for many Mormon businessmen, who found themselves at a ruinous disadvantage vis-a-vis Gentiles who could pursue action without impediment in the civil courts. And these forces pushed Mormons to abandon the church courts. As one Mormon lawyer later explained, "For a good illustration, my bishop, an exceptionally splendid man, was in mercantile business in Salt Lake City. All ward bishops presided over a bishop's court. But he came to me and said, 'I have never sued a brother, and it greatly disturbs me to do so. But I must, or go into bankruptcy, and let the property of my debtors be taken by strangers who have recently come among us.' The conclusion was inevitable, and suits at law rapidly became common." Other forces were at work as well. After the Civil War, the first truly national capital markets emerged, and with them, the corporation became the dominant form of business organization. Initially, church courts had no problem taking jurisdiction over Mormon-dominated corporations, including municipal corporations and city governments. However, church leaders eventually decided to disclaim all jurisdiction over corporations. The separation of ownership and control inherent in the corporate form necessarily created legal duties on the part of directors and officers. Did a Mormon corporate officer with a fiduciary duty to bring suit on behalf of a corporation violate his religious duties if the corporation sued another Mormon? Ironically, the first presidency found itself in the position of seeking legal advice from its general counsel on the fiduciary duties of members in order to resolve cases appealed to it, injecting lawyers into the apex of a system that was designed to exclude them from adjudication. Ultimately, they decided that rather than wading into such difficulties, church courts should simply disclaim such jurisdiction. Litigation over the ownership of land also illustrates the increasingly complex legal environment as the 19th century progressed. When the Mormons arrived in Utah in 1847, they were technically in Mexican territory, and they had no legal right to be there. The next year, when the territory was transferred to the United States, there was no effort made to grant them title to their land. So legally speaking, they were squatters. People obtained title to land on the basis of grants of land that were offered by the church as ecclesiastical land grants. Virtually all of the settlements began as church-sponsored missions, which created a problem in terms of who actually had title to the land. It led to a contradictory Mormon attitude. On one hand, they wanted federal officials to come in and regularize title to their land. On the other hand, they were frightened that federal law would allow outsiders to come in and take their land from them. Nor were their suspicions on this front entirely unjustified. "There can be no doubt," wrote the Federal Surveyor General of Utah in 1864, "that the true policy of the government in regard to Utah is to encourage the immigration to that territory of a population less hostile to the United States than that at present." He went on to say, "To do this, Gentile immigrants must have a chance of acquiring title to the land and must be protected in that title." Eventually, title to land was regularized in the 1870s. However, it led to a lot of conflicts between title based on federal statutes and title based on earlier ecclesiastical grants of land. In 1896, the Church on Deseret News published an article instructing that in cases involving title to land, the church court should not consider them if requested to do so, as church discipline is such as it will not attempt the adjustment of any controversy where there might be a possibility of conflict with the laws of the land. The First Presidency's attitude, however, was very ambiguous and ambivalent on this point. In another letter, they said, "We cannot as a church put ourselves in the position of using church courts to enforce the laws or to set aside the decisions of the court. But if men who are members of the church act unjustly and transgress upon their neighbor's rights by the misuse of the law or by taking advantage, we can deal with them." Not surprisingly, the precise limits of the jurisdiction of church courts was unclear. And in 1907, a case reached the Utah Supreme Court, in which the court ruled that church authorities had brought improper pressure to bear on a woman to transfer title to land claimed under federal statutes. The case made national news and exposed the church to widespread charges of duplicity, as church leaders had claimed before congressional hearings that church courts did not adjudicate cases involving land. The year after that case, high church leaders resolved to further limit the jurisdiction of church courts. In October of 1908, a report for the First Presidency suggested that church courts not be used as agencies for the collection of ordinary debts, including debts that had been discharged in bankruptcy or otherwise enforceable at law. The report, however, reveals the same ambivalent attitude seen in the First Presidency letters of the decade before. "If a member of the church shall unjustly and in an unchristian-like manner bring his brother before the civil courts, or if there is an element of fraud or dishonesty on the part of the member who owes a debt which he refuses to pay, either would be liable for his fellowship in the church by the bishops or high council courts." The reality, however, was that the Mormon judiciary was already in decline by 1908. Indeed, in urban areas, Mormons seem to have largely abandoned the church courts by the turn of the century. In 1904, Mormon attorney James Moyle was called to a newly organized high council in Salt Lake City, where he continued to serve for more than 20 years. During that time, the high council did not consider a single civil dispute. Still, as late as 1919, church publications said, "We hold that in matters of differences between brethren, there is in which no specific infraction of the secular law is involved, in offenses called civil as distinguished from criminal, it is truly unworthy of members of the church, as it was in Paul's time, that brother goeth to law against brother, and that it stands to our shame if righteous judgment cannot be rendered among ourselves." I began with two contrasting stories, one about Mormon elders preaching to a court day crowd, and the other about Mormon elders adjudicating civil disputes in their temple. The arc connecting these events marks out the relationship between litigation and religion for 19th century Latter-day Saints. The Mormons wished to preach to the courthouse, denouncing its divisiveness, chicanery, and corrosive moral spectacle. At the same time, they wished to domesticate civil disputes, forcing litigious church members to embed their arguments within the theological narratives and institutional settings of the church. Suing before the ungodly was to be replaced by lawsuits in the temple. In 1856, Brigham Young compared litigation to a satanic froth. In 1872, however, he insisted, quote, that for a man to understand the law is very excellent. He went on to explain that the proper Mormon understanding of the law, they that understand the law, he insisted, are peacemakers. They are the legitimate lawyers. This vision of law properly understood could continue even in the absence of church courts deciding civil disputes, allowing the judgment of the temple to continue its sermon to the courthouse.
I'm always interested in your responses to Law Talk. You can email me at nbomann@wm.edu. You've been listening to Law Talk, the Legal Scholarship Podcast. Technical support is provided by William and Mary Law School. Our theme music was written and performed by John Schmidt. You can find more of John's work online at www.johnschmidt.com. That's J-O-N. And you can find Law Talk online at www.concurringopinions.com.